Yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast, broadcasting not live from the frozen, barren wastes of the northeastern Atlantic region of the so-called United States. Today's guest is Jasper Burns. Jasper is a poet, a writer, an educator, a father, and the editor of Commune magazine. In this interview, we're going to talk about a wide range of subjects. We're going to talk about his book, We Are Nothing and So Can You. That's how I became introduced to his work. It's an epic poem about the uprisings, or I should say inspired by the uprisings around 2010 that were happening all over the world, specifically in Oakland. Long live the Oakland Commune. And we're also going to talk about a recent piece that he wrote about called The Belly of the Revolution, about agriculture, logistics, and revolution, sort of looking at his moments in history and the role that food production has played in revolution. We're going to talk about Commune magazine and like the ideas behind it. Commune magazine is a fucking beautiful project. I'm a subscriber. I love it. And it's basically just this collaborative project with people from all over, sort of exploring these ideas of, you know, what revolutionary, anti-state, cooperative, you know, whatever, non-ideologically driven revolutionary projects can look like in the 21st century. I don't know if that's how they would describe it. Jasper gets way more into it in our conversation. And we're just going to talk about a couple other things, but that's mainly the three main subjects of this interview. So I hope you enjoy it. If you enjoy it, subscribe to Commune Magazine, pick up We Are Nothing and So Can You, and follow Jasper's work. And if you're one of the thousands of people who subscribe to this podcast and you get something out of it and you have the means, consider becoming a Patreon supporter. And you can, you know, donate $2 a month or $5 a month, whatever works for you, whatever you want to do. Awesome. And to the people who already do, you fucking rock. Soulcast is a proud member of the Channel Zero Podcast Network. And before we get into this interview, let's hear from some comrades from that project.
From Embers is a show produced about anarchist ideas and practice across so-called Canada. Every week we spend about an hour going in-depth about ideas, histories, and ongoing struggles that we think are important. We're a part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. You can check it all out at fromembers.libsyn.com.
Jasper Burns, welcome to the Soulcast. Thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks for coming on. How's it going out there in Berkeley right now?
It's going pretty well. I just heard that the teachers in Oakland won some kind of contract that the Oakland Education Association is saying is a pretty good deal. I haven't heard the details on it, but it sounds like a victory. You never know until you really see what the paper says and hear what the rank and file think. It sounds potentially quite excellent.
Yeah, it's crazy in this era of, you know, the rise of flat earth that teachers would be some of the people fighting back the hardest, you know?
Right. Well, you know, part of it is that I think that they have a kind of leverage that workers in the private sector don't really have. So you can kind of manipulate the political system to put pressure on the school board and get them to concede. Whereas it's harder to do that with, you know, Elon Musk or something like that. It's, you know, it's just, I think that the public sector strikes have a bit more play than private sector ones do right now.
Yeah, and I mean, the good thing about that is like they keep rippling, and once you can just imagine how that's resonating with people all over the country.
It's really inspiring, and it's great, you know, because I think that education is something that really involves entire communities, and so you know you see this kind of solidarity between teachers and you know, residents and parents and students, people in the community, then that's I think really promising.
Are you currently teaching?
I'm not teaching this quarter. I didn't take any work on this quarter because I needed to just kind of get ahead of some of this Commune magazine work. But maybe in the spring.
Cool.
Or summer. Yeah. I do frequently teach college.
That's awesome. Yeah, I saw that you taught at UC Davis and places like that, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I've taught all around the Bay Area.
It's a rat race in California, from what my homies have told me out there trying to be teachers.
It's a rat race everywhere if you're an academic. It's just, you know, it's hard. It's really difficult. The struggle is real.
Well, it's a good thing you write poetry, because that's a surefire way to just get rich.
So. Yeah, totally. That's why I was able to take that quarter off. I'm just, you know, spending those royalty checks.
Yeah, well, it's cool to be able to, you know, talk to you right now as you're like on the beaches of Fiji, you know, writing your next book. It's awesome.
Blockbuster poem.
Blockbuster poem. So I don't know. I don't even remember when I read this book. I feel like it must have been 3 years ago or something. We Are Nothing and So Can You.
Not about 3 years ago.
Yeah, I've had sort of this ongoing conversation with comrades, a mutual friend of ours, I think, B from Crime Think. We've just been kind of just talking about radical poetry, and there's just such a lack of it, you know? And so I would have to go back to like, you know, Roke Dalton or, you know, it's hard to find. And especially modern radical anti-state poetry is just, it either isn't very good or it doesn't really, it's hard to find. And then, but your book is like this fucking epic poem of, you know, it's like dark, but also really inspiring. So I guess let's just start with that. Like what was sort of the motivation behind We Are Nothing and So Can You?
Well, I just, it came out of a whole sequence of experiences and struggles that I participated in here in the Bay Area. And, you know, I was just kind of writing poems while participating in these things. Then eventually I came to realize that I was working on a book that would sort of bring it all together and that would sort of think about the relationship between, you know, what was happening in the present, as it were, and kind of a revolutionary past and then also a revolutionary future. So that's sort of the idea behind the book. And, you know, that's the kind of movement in between the two types of sections in the book. You know, it alternates between these prose passages and then these lineated, more verse passages. That kind of movement is in some ways a kind of movement between, you know, the present and the future, or the present and the past. It changes, but the movement is a kind of temporal movement.
Yeah, and that's what I loved about it, is I just felt like I was like there, you know, and you just sort of have this feeling of like, you know, all of the, you know, struggles of human history at your back, and I don't know, it's, but at the same time, it's also, you know, it's like imagining a future. It's like imagining what if Occupy Oakland kept growing and then the state grows more dystopian and then, you know, and then it like.
Exactly. Right. But that's how it feels, right? I mean, that's the amazing thing is that when you're in these moments, it, you know, it induces this kind of temporary insanity that you participate in with other people. And we can look back now and say, okay, of course that was never going to happen. You know, of course it was never going to become the insurrection. But when you're in it, it kind of feels like it might. And I think that's necessary for those moments. They wouldn't be what they were if they didn't have that kind of crazy optimism to them. And you also kind of feel the presence of these other revolutionary moments. And, you know, people talk about them, right? They're always, you know, there's a way in which those kinds of other eras are really present in people's minds and in their discussion because people are trying to kind of think of examples. So, it really does feel like kind of that those moments collapse present, future, and past into one moment.
Yeah, and like that feeling you're talking about, it's something I feel like I've only really felt in Athens and like where like people are just different. You know, like the further you push capitalism out of your life, like the more you're like surviving in these like, you know, autonomous, you know, this autonomous space, the more,
yeah, you
know, the more your language changes, the more your, you know, perception of the world changes. It's, and they feel, these people feel different, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man, I miss it. Cause I feel like all around me, it's really the opposite. You know, no one's pushing capital out of their life right now.
Well, we can, man. Just for the next 45 minutes. But you know, but again, that's what I love. You know, and like to just go back to like your, you know, in Commune Mag, you recently wrote this book, this piece about Ursula Le Guin and how, you know, communism could last for a million years. And I feel like, you know, maybe what you started doing with We Are Nothing, but what you're doing with this Ursula Le Guin is just kind of like, I feel like you're trying to like expand the, you know, the poetic imagination and to kind mm-hmm. of, and, or the radical imagination, I should say. And, yeah. Because everything around us is so bleak right now.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's basically what Le Guin says. And she's, you know, she talks about the need for these realists of a larger reality. I believe I'm quoting her correctly. And she's sort of imagining science fiction writers as one example of this kind of realist of a larger reality. But, you know, a different kind of realism that really thinks about the kind of human possibility and the survival of humans and, you know, our possible flourishing in some kind of future as, you know, necessary to survive these kinds of dark times that are coming.
Yeah, it was just I guess as I've been going through that, I went and watched that speech that she gave the other day, and it I just love that. Yeah, that's what she says. Poets, artists, and visionary thinkers are realists of a greater reality. But also, I've just been kind of thinking about, you know, you go on social media and you just see a litany of just horrible things. And I feel like what ties into that is like how our subconscious how like the role that plays in like our subconscious minds. If like we're not like, it's hard to like dream when all you see is terrible things all mm-hmm. the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really confining. And you know, I feel sort of hopeless a lot of the time. And you know, if I'm honest, I think that, you know, our chances aren't particularly great, but I have to believe that there's a possibility, you know, that we can kind of make it out of this. And it's just, it's really important to keep in mind that possibility. I couldn't really imagine living without it. Just like it would be too bleak, you know, to think about, you know, my children and the life that they're going to live without sort of imagining that possibility.
Yeah. And
it does look bad. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just saw the thing the other day about like a cloudless sky And I was like, congratulations, yeah. humanity.
That's
like,
fucking me up.
Like, you've fucking created a world that even the bleakest sci-fi writers didn't even imagine.
Absolutely, you know, and every day there's another story like that. So we don't have, you know, some eras might have an absence of that kind of imagination, you know, an absence of being able to imagine the worst, but we don't. On the contrary, right? We lack an ability to imagine, you know, kind of human flourishing and, you know, a kind of an emancipated society.
I guess my question would be then, like, is that, like, in your mind, I don't know if, like, you subscribe to the quote unquote communization theory. Do you?
Yeah, you could. I mean, in a way, you could say that. Yeah, I'm influenced by communization writers. A really formative influence on my thinking was this group, Théorie Communiste, this kind of French communist theory journal. And their ideas are really complex and weird, but they, you know, they have a lot to contribute if you're kind of willing to translate it a bit. So yeah, that sort of thinking has been really formative for me. And I'm trying to kind of explain those ideas. You know, I'm trying to kind of take them out of the realm of obscure Marxist theory and boil them down to some kind of essential sort of insights that can be shared with somebody who hasn't, you know, read all of Marx or, you know, spent a lot of time studying communist theory.
Is there a relationship between that stuff and like the Invisible Committee Tycoon kind of stuff?
You know, when it first became popular in the, you know, in the English speaking world and people started to read these French communization theorists, they did try to link them with the Invisible Committee and books like The Coming Insurrection and the De Kooning writers. But they're really very, very different bodies of thought. And I mean, the kind of apelist writers, the people associated with, you know, The Call and De Kooning and The Coming Insurrection and the Invisible Committee, you know, they sort of believe that you can build communism now, like you can produce communism, you know, in the present, in advance of any kind of revolutionary moment. And the communization theory people are saying the opposite, right? They're saying there's no hope of trying to do that. And that you really, you know, that communism can only emerge in these moments of rupture. And that's a big difference. Now, of course, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of things that you could find that those writers would agree with, but they come from really different spaces in France.
Right. Yeah. Cause I've tried to read like endnotes and trying to understand what communization theory was. And I just was like, I don't fucking get it, but I love the Invisible Committee.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot that that the Invisible Committee brings to the table, you know, I mean, and I think that there are a lot of points of overlap in terms of an analysis of the present. Like one thing that the Invisible Committee writers have emphasized is kind of the importance of logistics and the circulation of capital in these kinds of spaces where, you know, in the flow of things. And that's something I write about. And I write about it from this kind of communization perspective in a way. But I think I share a lot tactically with the kind of Invisible Committee writers. And I think there's a kind of shared perspective there, even if the meaning of those things is a bit different.
Right. I mean, especially like I'm kind of jumping around here, but it's okay. I don't know if you've like been to Tarnac or any of those, or like Lazad or any of those places.
Never, no. But I've heard about it.
Seeing those places like kind of changed, it changed my life. I was like, oh my God, why don't we have this shit like this in the States, you know?
Sure.
Like really, like being out in the middle.
People are trying to do that.
I'm sorry?
Well, people are trying to do that, right? I mean, they're trying kind of to bring that there.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm thinking of, like, the Inhabit folks.
Sure, there's definitely a lot of people who are influenced by that spirit in the United States right now. I think it's a pretty active and kind of vital current, right?
Yeah. Hey, I got chickens.
There you go. Yeah. I think chickens, I mean, if you have chickens, you're like basically just only like two steps away from communism. Like, first chicken, then, you know. I don't know what the step after chickens is, but I think that chickens is an important step.
Yeah, chickens, then a food forest, and, you know, then hydro farms, and then robots to pick all of the shit for you. I mean, bam.
Yes.
Eat your heart out, Murray Bookchin. Well, let's talk about Commune magazine a little bit. I'm a subscriber. I really like it. It's beautiful.
Right.
But so, you know, when I talk to, or just explain to me, like, the relation, like, does Commune have like a specific analysis or relationship to like great communist thinkers, or quote unquote great communist thinkers, like Lenin, Mao, Marx, is it trying to make a break from those things, or is it just trying to update things?
We don't really have a line in that way, and I don't think we're even specifically communist. I mean, we're very open to anarchists, or people who may identify neither as anarchist nor communist. They may prefer some kind of other term, but who are kind of, you know, pro-revolutionary, against the state, against capitalism. So we're trying to create a pretty big tent. And though a lot of us on the editorial board are more or less communists, we don't think of this magazine as promoting a particular view. It's more like a, you know, conversation that's bringing together people from, you know, a variety of different perspectives. So I publish all kinds of things I disagree with. And, a project like that could never survive if it was just trying to kind of, you know, articulate one view.
That's awesome. Yeah, I guess it's just because, like, you know, there's so, like, in this time, you know, I it seems like there's a whole lot of, like, people, like, the rise of groups like PSL and, like, uh-huh. like, you know, DSA and just all these different, like, socialist groups. Sure. And, like, people who are, like, you know, poring over the classic texts. And it makes me just wonder if, like, you know, people are so scared and times are so uncertain that they're, like, hoping to find, like, some sacred truth that can just be easily applied, right, and lead us to freedom.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's really a time and a place for that. And I've spent a lot of time nerding out, reading Marx and, you know, getting involved in obscure debates and obscure historical researches. And that's, you know, I think a totally valid thing to do with your time. And it's also totally valid to create a journal that has a very unique, narrow perspective and, you know, yells it from the rooftops. It's just not, you know, we're trying to create this kind of magazine that has a kind of breadth in terms of its readership and its, and the writers it's drawing in. But yeah, I mean, it is a bizarre moment politically. It's dawned on me how much of my generation I am and how different things are right now. And, you know, I'm trying to make sense of it, really. It's no longer the kind of moment of, you know, Occupy or Black Lives Matter. It's, you know, really a kind of different political moment with different problems and different promises.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I'm 40 and – or 41, actually. You know, I guess you stop counting after 40. And
yeah.
And you know, I'm a musician by trade for 20 years. It's like, you know, my job. And I've never felt like a generational disconnect until this year.
Yeah. It's funny. The same thing, you know, I've always, you know, I kind of came to this a bit late, so I didn't really start getting into it until my 30s and this kind of political work. And I've always, you know, I've always been the older one. I've always been around people who were a lot younger than me. And it's never, I've never really felt much of a disconnect or a gap. You know, I might go home a little bit earlier. You know, I don't stay out and party all night, but not, neither does everyone. Right. But yeah, I've definitely been feeling that this year too. And I think it's inevitable. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. And that's, but that's, it's like, you know, when thinking about it in relation to Commune Mag, like what I like about it is that it's like, you know, I can take the magazine into the bath and read it like I would read a book.
Right.
Whereas like, you know, this generation, or I should say like the way that things are, our society is kind of pushing us now isn't even, it's like put it in a meme or put it on like, or squeeze the thesis into 124 characters.
Right. I don't, you know, and I love that stuff. It's, I think it's, I think there's a real kind of intelligence and excitement to, you know, those formats. But yeah, it is, I, you know, there's a way there, in a way, you know, we didn't want to make Commune, too generational of a magazine. I mean, most of my co-editors are not of my generation. They're much younger than I am. And, you know, but we didn't want to kind of try to make ourselves a millennial magazine because I think there's something kind of sort of opportunistic about that. And also I want Commune to be something that, you know, my mom could read because I think there's a lot of people out there who are, you know, older and who really are kind of radicalized in this moment and, you know, who are looking for something that kind of explains why they've suddenly decided that, you know, cops just need to be got rid of altogether. And, but if you only write towards millennials, those, you know, they're going to feel alienated, right? You know, if you put it in a kind of a meme format, my mom probably isn't going to get it. So, you know, it's, I try to kind of, we do have a kind of your mom test, around the Commune offices where we sort of think about, you know, it's the legibility of our articles for, you know, people who are, and also people, you know, who are outside of the U.S. and they have kind of really different kind of cultural perspectives. You know, you don't want to get too pigeonholed.
Right. You don't want it to read like an academic philosophy thing.
Yeah, you don't want that, but you also don't want it to just be so kind of so you know, within kind of left internet culture, that, you know, that the people who aren't online don't really understand it. Because there are in fact a lot of people who aren't really, you know, extremely online, and you know, don't really hang out on Twitter or these other places. So
right, they're not like, you know, knee deep in like debates between tankies and, you know,
exactly,
you know, these like just crazy wormholes that I avoid. But
yeah, I do too. I used to go to battle online all the time, and now I just don't have the energy for it.
But like this word commune, actually, I feel like the first time it popped up in American, on my radar was the Oakland Commune. And I was just like, fuck yeah, you know? But like, is it, I don't even know what my question is there, but I guess my question is like, is it like a, it's not necessarily a physical space, right? It's like it's an idea of, you know, like the shared power.
Yeah, I think I think that the term is really nice because it crosses between idea and physical space. You know, the commune is an ideal in one sense, right? It's something you aspire to, but of course it can't, it's not real until it's real. Like, it's supposed to be based in, you know, we call something a commune because it's based in material processes, right? It actually, you know, things are actually common and communal in the commune, or it's not a commune, right? It's just everyday life in capitalism or some other class society. So it's nice in that way that it's, you know, both an ideal you might strive toward, but also something very real that needs to be made real. You know, whether it's the Paris Commune or the Oakland Commune. And, you know, of course, when we were calling Occupy Oakland the Oakland Commune, that was partly a name for, you know, kinds of living in common or communal living that people were doing, but it was also partly an aspiration, right? We were naming ourselves that in order to, you know, become more of a commune, or looking forward to a moment when, you know, the government in Oakland had been deposed and there was a real Oakland commune, you know, that had taken over all of the kind of resources of that part of California, was distributing it, you know, for free to everyone.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, like, I had like this, you know, a little break this afternoon. And so I was like rereading, We Are Nothing and So Can You. And it was like bringing me back to, like, you know, Denver, where I was in Denver. Denver was pretty popping during Occupy as well. But
yeah, I remember. Yeah, I followed a lot of what was going on in Denver.
But you know, Oakland kept on taking it. And it was just really exciting to watch Oakland. And
yeah, it was exciting to be there. And, you know, it was sort of hard to figure out what to do after that moment was over.
Yeah, and it's crazy. It still hasn't – we really haven't seen anything really like it. I mean, Black Lives Matter, the anti-police stuff was interesting, you know, but
– It was really powerful, and I think in some ways, you know, much more explosive and widespread. But it didn't have that. It didn't really offer people the chance to kind of settle in and sort of create a sort of new way of living. I think people were sort of exhausted at that prospect of, you know, Occupy. And, you know, of course, it's had a completely different content. And I, you know, I think that there were moments of kind of commune formation, especially in Ferguson, and I think Minneapolis had that as well, and a lot of other places. But it was just more dissipative and explosive. But, you know, maybe ultimately more important,
right? Because a lot of the problems from Occupy started getting kind of worked out, you know, or at least brought to the table about, you know, whiteness.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, Occupy was it was a much wider movement in most of the country. And it, you know, it sort of brought together this middle class layer with this kind of population of, you know, homeless people. And, so, I mean, the kind of racial and class dynamics of it were just completely different. But, you know, in Oakland, it became something else eventually. And I think, you know, I think it's probably each place had its own kind of local characteristics. Yeah. Right. But yeah, so, you know, but I think that moment of, you know, assembly, for lack of a better term, and that doesn't mean really a kind of formal process of decision making, which is probably the least important part of it, but just the chance to kind of like come together and to, you know, change your relationship to the other people around you is really indispensable. You know, because it keeps the kind of the sort of political groups from staying stuck in their habits, you know, and there's a lot of that right now. Right. And, you know, that's the importance of these kinds of moments, is that they, you know, all these different political groups and people with different ideas come into them, and then they get transformed. All their networks are different. after. But that requires a bit more patience and a kind of a movement that's based around street riots. It just moves too quickly for that in some way,
Right. But at least you're coming into contact with, like now I feel like everybody's retreated into filter bubbles, and for lack of a better word, whereas back then, you didn't really have as many options to self-select when when seven people want to do the same thing and they're all very different people, and you kind of are like, oh, there's this weird old hippie guy and this liberal person, right. And like they both have good ideas, kind of like maybe we can do something right here. Like,
yeah, I mean, well, that's actually one of the worst things about the American left, and maybe it's a problem with the left in other places. I don't know those lefts as well, but I mean, just the degree to which people are really unwilling to have conversations with anyone they don't know, and risk somebody else being wrong or stupid or offensive or annoying. It's awkward to have conversations with strangers, but it's pretty much a requisite for any meaningful politics. And I think that in some ways the sort of structure of social media makes us less good at that than ever. And that's not good.
Yeah, it's funny. I left Denver this summer to like move back home to my family in Maine and like buy a farm and whatever and like just try to grow food. And I was at the – and so it's like I'm not surrounded by anarchists anymore. I'm surrounded by – I don't even know. And I'm at the bagel shop the other day and this woman is looking at my shirt and asking me questions about anarchism or something. And so I just gave her the overview of it's the idea that like people can make their own decisions about the world and it was like the first time I'd had to like describe my politics to someone who I wasn't already in a political space with in a while. And it was like, wait a second, this is how people used to do it. This is like what people used to stand on soapboxes and like try to like, and I'm like, man, I'm like, this is a rusty blade in my back pocket. Like I need to sharpen this.
Fucking thing. Absolutely. We all need to sharpen that blade, but we have to be able to kind of represent these ideas to regular people on the street. But you also have to be in a moment where people are receptive. There's no point in walking down the street and just knocking on doors and, saying, have you heard about the Lord Savior anarchism? Most people are not going to be receptive to that. But, if you're in a kind of moment of crisis where something just happened, then maybe people are, and then you really do need to get out there and just have conversations with people. That was the thing that was the most exciting about that kind of Oakland commune, Occupy Oakland moment. It wasn't the kind of the level of damage or destruction, all of which was very exciting, but it was just being out there on these moments where there was, 40 or 50,000 people in the streets, which is, there's only, 400,000 people in Oakland. So that's a lot of people. And just seeing everyone, running into these people who as like completely apolitical, right? And they're out there and they're kind of into it. And you just, there's this moment when, the event becomes so pervasive that it's just pulling in everyone. It's radicalizing everyone. And then, a day later, those people were gone because we weren't really in an insurrectionary moment. But that's what it would be like. It would be everybody in the street. The people that you thought were completely apolitical suddenly become, so incredibly passionate.
Right.
It's bizarre.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what I will say is the woman at the bagel shop liked my pitch. and, you know, was like, that makes cool. sense. Was like, that makes sense to me. And I was like, all right, I need to talk to more. I need to go to more bagel shops.
You could the bagel shop gospel.
Yeah.
That could be your thing.
Like, if you like everything bagels, then you might like, you know.
Anarchism. Yeah, anarchism isn't everything bagel.
That it is. So, you know, I don't know how much time you have, so I just kind of, like, as I – basically, like, I became friends with Phil Neal on Facebook because I'm, like, reading his book and I wanted to talk to him. And then I just saw you and I was like, oh, shit. Yeah. This guy is, like, accessible. Like, I'm fucking going to talk to this motherfucker. And then as we were, like, chatting through Facebook, you sent me this recent piece about food and logistics and about food and logistics and revolution. And I've really been trying to develop an analysis around, like, food autonomy. And and so it just, like, it was like some of the best writing I found on this. And so it's a real nice bonus that you have been thinking about this stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's really cool. So the first part that I wanted to kind of get you to talk about was, this moment in history where there's, like, advances in farming techniques and advances in capitalism and, like, private property and how capitalism, like, disposed farmers and drove them to cities to create this metabolic rift. Mm-hmm. You talk about that? I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. Once you get into agricultural history and agricultural science and just the it's incredibly fascinating. The sort of agricultural history is just, it sounds like a boring topic, but actually it's incredibly fascinating. And in some ways, you know, I mean, agricultural history is human history, right? As I say, all revolutions, and this is pretty much true in however, whatever sense of the word you mean, have been agricultural revolutions, right? I mean, the major changes in human society have occurred around changes in the way that people grow food and what kinds of food they grow or how they eat. And I think all of the political revolutions, the social revolutions, have really turned around the question of food, as is probably entirely unsurprising, right? Because, you know, people make revolutions largely because they're starving. And revolutions, you know, succeed or fail depending on whether they can keep people from starving. So, among other things. So, yeah, it's just that the topic is really fascinating. But, yeah, the thing that I learned about capitalism is that we're told this story about capitalism and other kinds of modes of human society. And the story generally goes, you know, first there was this kind of innovation, and then this new set of social relations came about in response to that innovation. So, you know, society was becoming gradually more and more productive because of the printing press and these new methods of farming and whatever. And so that produced this change in social relations, introduced capitalism and ideas around private property and money and et cetera, et cetera. But that story is actually wrong. In some ways, it's the changes in social relations are a requirement of those technological changes. So, you know, for instance, the method of of crop rotation, which is a huge advance in agricultural productivity. It was something that people had known about for a long time. It's just that it's not possible except in societies where people have owned the land, right? And most societies had this kind of commons method in which, a certain part of the land belonged to anyone. So you couldn't do certain kinds of things because somebody else might come and graze their animals on it. And therefore, you couldn't do this kind of crop rotation thing very effectively. It only became possible to do crop rotation and increase the kind of yield of the land you know, threefold or something like that. Once people actually had ownership over their land, they could keep everyone else out. So you had to have this change in property relations before you could have the kind of the new agricultural technology. And, you know, and that tells us that sometimes these kinds of technologies, they have at their basis a kind of politics to them. That doesn't mean maybe you can't use them for some other thing, but they're produced by this political moment. So, you know, that's interesting. And I think that's true of a lot of the later advances in, you know, agricultural productivity, especially once we start – once humans figure out how to synthesize nitrogen from the atmosphere and take kind of nitrogen out of the air and turn it into fertilizer through a chemical process. That was a huge advance, which suddenly meant that people no longer had to do things like crop rotation. They no longer had to conserve the available nitrogen in the soil. They could just dump it on the soil. And, you know, that's essentially the basis of the Green Revolution, which has increased, you know, food productivity by two or three times. But it's, you know, it's come at an incredible cost.
And then somewhere in the middle of this is like this metabolic rift, which is like, you know, I talked with Mackenzie Wark a little about this. I feel like it's an interesting concept to think of the Earth this way. So
right,
and you talked about it a little differently. So how would you describe that process of the metabolic rift?
Well, there's a lot of kind of internecine debates about what exactly the concept of rift means and how Marx used it and how we should understand it. And I don't know that ultimately those debates are that interesting. But I think that, you know, Marx was really interested in soil science and in the kind of new studies of agriculture that were being conducted in his time. I mean, he read everything. And this particular thinker, Liebig, had, you know, more or less figured out the relationship between kind of nitrogen and soil productivity. And, you know, for Marx and Engels, it was clear that what was being done with agriculture was completely unsustainable because there were these resources that all food required, these kinds of nutrients, largely nitrogen, but also phosphorus and stuff like that. And those nutrients were being taken out of the soil, right? And the soil kind of stripped. And then in Marx's time, there were these kinds of artificial sources for those nutrients, whether like guano deposits in South America that were being imported in order to dump on the soil. But those didn't seem very sustainable. And the problem for as Marx and Engels saw it was that all of the nutrients and resources from the land were being taken out of the land and brought to the cities and kept there as waste in the cities. And the waste itself that was, you know, originally this kind of these agricultural products wasn't being returned to the land, you know, as fertilizer. So essentially the shit was just, you know, being stockpiled in the cities as the land from whence that you know shit came was being kind of starved of nutrients. And so this kind of this cycle, this metabolic process between humans and nature had been interrupted through the growth of cities, right? Because people were sort of living so far from their food that the nutrients weren't being returned to the soil. You know, through this process of eating and defecation, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the rift, right? It's that human society kind of interrupts this process, this kind of this cycle of, you know, nutrients being taken out of the soil through plants consumed by humans, then humans eventually returning those nutrients to the land, right? If everybody's living in cities and they're kind of, you know, disposing of their waste in sewers, then that's not happening. And for Marx and Engels, they just thought that was insane, right? And it was also, you know, you have to understand that, of course, that's making the cities incredibly unhealthy at the same time. So they sort of imagine cities, these places where the working class were just kind of being stewing in their own, you know, their own waste and suffering from all these crazy diseases. Meanwhile, the land is being kind of starved of resources. That's what they thought of urbanization. So for them and for pretty much every other socialist or anarchist in the 19th century, it just made sense that a revolution would do away with cities. It would kind of end this, you know, separation of the town and the country. And you wouldn't have these kinds of poisoned urban spaces where the working class was stewing in its own, you know, waste. And you wouldn't have these denuded, stripped, barren agricultural spaces. You would kind of mix and merge them. So you would bring, you know, the benefits of industry to the rural zones, and you would kind of bring food production into, you know, towns. And that just made sense for them.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I thought, like, what I really liked about this piece and is how, like, some of the conclusions that you draw is that, like, if we're serious about, you know, revolution, quote, in quotation, or whatever, the revolutionary process, or maybe communization, as you would say, you know, that we should, like, that's the way, you know, that, like, that we're going to have to, that everyone would have to play a role in food production.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that just makes sense to me for a number of reasons. And also because I think that, you know, if each of us had to do a couple hours of work with food, you know, each week, that wouldn't be that bad. Actually, you might actually kind of enjoy it. It might be a nice kind of variety. And also it just kind of brings people closer to their food. You're not using all of these resources to ship food around the planet. I mean, there are some cases where kind of centralizing food production might be better. But I think in most cases, decentralizing it is going to make a lot more sense, especially as we're kind of needing to reduce, you know, carbon emissions, use less energy, transport things less. And it also, more importantly, maybe gives people power over their own food, right? And so if people are kind of have the things that they need to survive ready to hand, it's really hard to dispossess them of them. And it's really hard to kind of send the revolution back into class society, dispossess people of their kind of access to the things that they need to survive and render them kind of wage laborers again or some kinds of, subjects of some political order. So I think decentralization creates a more kind of robust and resilient revolutionary society.
Well, and not only that, like in the present, like, you know, from like a prefigurative political, you know, perspective, it's like, you know, good vegetables are expensive. You know, it's expensive to eat well.
Yeah. Totally.
And if you just have, you know, I've had just one salad bed that just has like onions and lettuce and kale. And like, I got, you know, between that and like a couple tomato plants, like I was fine. You know, like if you have like, I don't know, 12 or 16 kale plants, like that can feed,
right?
You can just fucking rip leaves off that all year. And you're just like,
yeah,
chilling. So it's like,
totally.
Like you
yeah,
can
totally
save money right now and be a,
no, it's great.
Be a good revolutionary too.
It's great. I mean, and you know, I'm always inspired by the things that comrades are doing with kind of food production. I mean, I got to spend some time in Bloomington last year where people just have so much capacity. They've, you know, they're really just growing so much food and doing all these kinds of things with food production and distribution in a kind of, you know, non-capitalist way. And it's really inspiring.
Out here in Maine, the hacker thing to do is to grow rice. So I'm trying to grow rice this year. So rice is another one of those things that, like, I would never think of growing rice. But it's like...
Uh-huh. That sounds hard. Growing rice sounds very hard.
Well, I'll send you an email next year and we'll see. I don't know. I haven't really done a lot of research for it. I just bought the seeds and I have a pond. So I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to see what happens.
Do it.
And another thing you talked about in this piece that I thought was interesting was like coercion and like, you know, how like revolutions that have centralized food where food is food production is like centralized to a certain extent. They like dig their own graves because they have to essentially like result to coercion. And you use the Spanish Civil War and Stalinist Russia as examples.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a bit more. Yeah. The argument that I make there is it's really about whether the revolutionary zone, you know, the area in which the kind of revolution has taken over the existing kind of resources and is distributing them in some kind of non-capitalist way, it's whether that zone is going to be dependent on kind of trade with producers, capitalist producers in other parts of the world, right? And my argument is that if you continue to kind of maintain those relations of dependence, you're setting yourself up for disaster because you can never trade with partners on kind of even terms. Like the revolutionary zone is never going to be as productive as those other kinds of places because, you know, it's a revolution, right? The first thing that happens in a revolution is people stop going to work. So there's always – it's going to be very, very hard for that revolutionary zone to produce things to trade, you know, unless it has very unique advantages. And, you know, so what happens is that then the revolutionary zone will have to kind of exert labor discipline in order to kind of have stuff to trade, in order to, you know, get everybody to go back to work and work really hard so that they can, you know, buy weapons or buy whatever they need from these kinds of other capitalist trading partners. And I think that, you know, there's just many examples of that as a kind of a failed strategy. So, you know, instead you have to kind of really try to kind of localize those resources as much as possible. And, you know, it may not be completely possible, right? Like, say, some things you may still need to trade for, but you want to kind of reduce that dependence as much as possible while the revolution is expanding. It's not an argument for, you know, socialism in one country or something like that, or even the nation state. This is, you know, completely independent of any kind of state structure. Nonetheless, I think those kinds of market relations can be really disastrous.
Basically, I'd just like to ask everyone at the end of the interview, like, I would like to ask you, you know, if people are interested in this subject, like you have a book coming out on this, I'm sure it'll be very interesting. I look forward to reading it.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm working on this book that includes the essay that you read, The Belly of the Revolution, and a couple other, number of other pieces that I'm sort of, that are form part of a larger argument about revolution in the 21st century, what it might look like, the kinds of pitfalls that revolutionaries might encounter. So look out for that. It's going to be called The Communist Prospect. I think that expected publication date is 2020, so not for a little while.
Nice.
But and then yeah, check out Commune Magazine. We're putting up new articles every few days, and our second issue is about to start arriving in people's hands in March. There's a lot of exciting stuff. I would actually recommend that your readers check out this essay by CE called How to Seize the Means, which is actually a kind of really interesting investigation of these kinds of questions about, you know, what revolution might look like.
Awesome. And if people want to track your work in particular, is there like a Jasper Burns page?
I do have a website, jasperburns.net, that I keep pretty updated. And yeah, you can just Google me. Lots of stuff will come up. There aren't any other Jasper Burnses out there. So you're unlikely to get me confused with another person.
That's awesome. Well, hey, man, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about your work. And, you know, much respect, man.
Thanks. Maybe we'll run into each other someday.
I'm sure we will. I came, I saw, I wrote the book, I burned the books, got scrapers full, I hate them all. No fan of summer, give me spring or give me fall. When winter comes, I dig a hole. No time for hibernation, universe is sweating deep in
ocean lava's rising. Anarchy rising, not surprising. Autonomy rising, not surprising. In a time of invention, time of tension. Some are plugging in holes, but not in fences. Firemen of the future, but feel your pain. Putting it out is against the grain. Don't cry for me, I can't for you. All out of tears, I wish it were true. As days go on, I wonder what it's worth. The scale of the ways a bomb will burst. Here in the mud, it's hard to listen. Counting the bodies is not a privilege. Deciding dead ends with politics is. Russian flies off, we call a living. Savannahs of Texas, where have you gone? Into the dust like Bush's grave. Almost forgotten like CEOs. We'll get but our lives in the dollar store. Firemen in the future will feel your pain. Long live the Rocky Mountain Range. Apologies in advance for the rough terrain. Cheers to you with acid rain. I got nothing to show you but my trauma. What are we all but a melting glacier? Beyond sadness, the act of aging. Beyond fear, well that's not an option. Put it to sleep, we skip the lecture. City's gone dark, made us electric. Who acted matter more than who got elected? Who acted matter more than who got elected? Only thing I miss is ignorance of the youth. All these years dig and still ain't found no truth. And the ones I found I just can't share. Cause it's bleak except for this world of me. Workers in cages, rappers too. An economy built on hamster wheels. Go ask the crows, they know us well. We never ran out of shit to sell. Off in the woods in the name of greed. A sick propaganda of the deed. Fat on my ass is human need. Watching it all from a TV screen. They say human life is like a dream. A mushroom trip that you can't come down. Heavy is the head that lies the crown. If you don't take it off, you'll likely drown. Policemen of the present, no one feels your pain. You were the glue that forced us in pens. Into the cells, the hurricanes hit. And when it turned to fire, you left us there. No pity for you when you hung from bridges. I stood in the crowd and held your children. No one deserved to see death. Daddy swinging, but you've been doing that since the beginning. I sing this from the burning shores of Maine. Firemen of the future will feel your pain. I sing this from the burning shores of Maine. Firemen of the future will feel the pain. I sing this from the burning shores of Maine. Firemen of the future will feel your pain. I sing this from the burning shores of Maine. Firemen of the future will feel your pain. I sing this from the burning shores of Maine.
Future will fill your pain.